Off the Ball Rugby.
Pretty incredible. Only Johnny Sexton really could do this. So look, I know he was a de facto coach anyway. You know, I would imagine there's a few coaches out there whose noses are probably out of joint by this.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
Yeah, you just had to be there.
You know, you had to be there.
And it was just great to say, like, Ari was there for that. You know what I mean?
You had to be there.
I wish I wasn't there.
You had to be there.
All right, Dara O'Brien, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you both?
Yeah, great. Thanks very much for doing this for us.
No, delighted. Absolutely. I was having to take a trip down Sporting Memory Lane, as it were.
Was it difficult for you to pick a list of five?
Yeah, there was particularly the last one I was choosing between, because I thought I'd classify them, you know, put them so they didn't overlap in any way. So there's great moments. I didn't repeat sports, really. I had to pick the best of things that probably deserve to be in of their own accord, like whatever. Yeah, it was interesting. I like attending sports. I mean, like, it's like, you know, I like crowds at the best of times. I like being among crowds, and I like the dynamics of that. So it's one of the things that I try to shift my life towards getting to do as much as possible.
What are your big sporting loves? There's certainly Arsenal, isn't there?
Yeah, there'd be Arsenal, hurling. I think it's Arsenal, hurling are kind of there and thereabouts together. Yeah. Probably I'm in London, so Arsenal wins that more often. And then there's just a general class of, you know, like the Olympics, like attending things and, you know, being there in that moment, like the whether or not I would actually go to a lot of archery finals normally. I made an exception last summer. And it was honestly, that was like number six on the list, the archery final, the men's archery final last year at the 24. It was a phenomenal event. Came down to one arrow each, and it was like pure Robin Hood who gets closest to the bull. The obscure ones that just pop up are a joy as well. I just enjoy this. Just that emotion, that kind of liveness of it all as well.
Yeah. It's class. I love that those obscure sports and Olympics too, because we all get carried away and become archery experts for 35 minutes. And there's nothing I don't know about archery in that half an hour. Ask me anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh no, look, I had strong opinions on the American lad and how he'd never want to go into that. And this is very important to him now, but he clearly wasn't going to. Whereas South Koreans, you know, there was one point there was a batch of South Koreans beside us, and then these two other South Koreans arrived, to whom they all deferred enormously, and we couldn't work out if it's because they're celebrities or because they were royalty. They were in no way recognizable as the rest of us, but there was just a huge all the South Koreans would turn and see these two, this couple go, and then they'd come over and very deferentially bow to them and shake their hand like this. All sorts of theatre going on. It's a glorious thing. Can't see myself going to LA, because it just doesn't feel it has that. You know, I like a contained Olympic Games. In my long experience of attending two of them, I like a contained one. So I think Brisbane might be the next one. But you know what? It's a curveball. Yeah, and the Winter Olympics, that might be fun there. That might be an interesting one to go to.
I don't know what the Winter Olympics would be like as a TV spectator sport. As a spectator sport actually to be at, the whoosh of the thing past you, like, who is that? It's a bit like Formula One.
Oh, look, no, things I wouldn't bother attending include Formula One, golf, anything where you're seeing a fragment of stuff, and you're essentially there as a hot prop, or Glastonbury, similarly. Glastonbury is, you're basically at one stage cheering, and it's much better as a television spectacle. It's so great that other people attend to supply the audience noise for your enjoyment as a television spectacle. I think you could pick out ones that would work. One of the big ski jump finals, you know, that one. Yeah, yes. Absolutely. That one. That would be an amazing thing to be sitting at. Like whether or not coming the downhill would be, you know, but the randomness, curling. Would curling work on it? Like if you got to a particularly exciting game? Yeah. So I think I could randomly get into it. It's whether you want to be in the Norwegian half of it, in which they do like the traditional stuff, or in the exports half. Which is another thing again entirely. I'm not sure the half pipe stuff appeals to me that much.
Fair enough. Can I ask you something that you said there about being around crowds? Was that like Was there something about the love of being at sports events that fed into your desire to be a stand-up?
Yeah, you know what? There is an element. Like, we don't presume that we are the same peak physical specimens as you get in the Olympics. But there is a bit of bob. You bob up and down before you go on stage. You shadowbox. You bob up and down. You get your energy up. Like, whatever. You, your presumption is that you are, whether it's a dance you think you're doing or whether it's a bout, there is an element of, you think the physicality is very important, and then you go and stand still in a room for 2 hours. They stand absolutely stock still, but there is, because there's energy in a room and you're moving the energy around, like and it's not the competitiveness of it. I think that's kind of overstated in comedy a bit, like whatever, the idea of like you're going bam bam bam, I got you, nailed your back. It's more the, maybe it's Torvald Dean's Bolero that I think I'm essentially doing for 2 hours, that that I have their attention and I'm doing this performance. But like, it is, you are aware this is a performance. Yeah. You are aware there's a moment where I do a thing before I walk on, where I go, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Vicar Street or whichever. Please welcome to stage, Dara O'Brien. And there is within that moment, do you know the bit in Severance where they're in the lift and their face subtly, like the camera zooms in on their face and they go from one thing to the other thing? You do that. And so you get into a kind of a headspace. You walk along a corridor and then you get to the point and then you're introduced, like whatever. So yeah, it is a performance. But I don't know how much did boxing borrow from us, or how much did we borrow from boxing. Yeah.
Because Andy Lee talks about, I don't know if you ever met Andy, but he's the world's nicest man. And then he transforms from being the world's nicest man into a knockout artist. But during the ring walking, you know, fine, 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 fine. And then all of a sudden, game face, and your job is to concuss your opponent. And if you do that well, you know, your opponent is lying, incapable of standing up again. As you say, the less combative in comedy.
In most conversations, I'm not trying to get a laugh every 15 seconds because that just gets incredibly irritating. But when you walk on stage, you're focused on that because it's just you talking as well. So you go into a different mode, I think. I mean, because look, any of us, if we're doing what we did on stage, we become incredibly irritating. The fridge door opens and we start hosting a show, that kind of thing. That would get very, very tiring very fast. But you do get into a different zone. But actually, it's the shadow bug that is a little rush of energy. You just get the adrenaline up and away you go.
You know, you hear sports people say if they're injured or suspended or just not playing, or I'm a bad watcher, I'm not good at watching these games, involved. Yeah. Are you a bad audience member at a stand-up gig?
No, I'm really, I laugh loudly and uproariously. I have a different laugh, apparently, my children say, that I do at a gig where I'm not going to slap the thigh, but there are things I prefer watching stuff that I'm not trying to jump ahead on in my own head, if you know what I mean, that I'm not trying to see how I would do that. Yeah. So there's the kind of stuff I would watch, I suppose, maybe for sports, I'm watching a sport they don't play. So if I'm watching someone do slapstick or there's types of not just physical comedy, like, you know, there's a mischief theatre company, the play that went wrong, those kind of shows where it's clowning more, which is not what I do, and I find that trips my brain and I laugh like a drain of that kind of stuff, but it's totally not what I do. So that might be, there might be an element of being unliberated that I'm not kind of going, oh yeah, but actually I enjoy stand up a lot. And so I'll go to Kilkenny and I'll duck into watch people's sets, and I will go to Edinburgh every year and watch people's shows and make sure I'm not sitting in the middle of it, because it's kind of weird to be there just directly in front of them. It's more rooms, I think I'm not quite that. I like it a lot. I don't see enough.
You often hear like the most common fear universally is public speaking, that kind of everyone has it to some degree. But like, I've seen you a number of times, and self-confidence seems to be in abundance. Like, and self-confidence, not in a bombastic way, it's very relaxed. Very relaxed. Yeah. Like, has that ever been an issue for you? Do you get nervous in front of large crowds?
No, there's larger. I mean, there was a description in the Times that said a casual ultra-confidence on stage. match was I remember, because I remember thinking, oh, you know, that's all right. That's the thing to aim for. Yeah. Just I look like I'm just having a conversation. Yeah. But no, you're certainly I thought when I initially started, I can't sustain this. I think the ulcers will kill me in this job, because there was a period of walking around, like I'll do, and I'd be doing like a 10-minute gig in the Comedy Cellar, even if that, like, or in a really small little club somewhere back in the mid-90s, and I would walk around for hours beforehand, just, you know, just in turmoil, stomach and just acid running, and just absolutely torn apart by the nerves of it all, like whatever. But the switch from being off stage to on stage is a huge thing, and you begin to see the audience as an animal that you can get a rush out of. And yeah, I'm lucky, I suppose, look, what I do is conversational, and so I can just appear like I appear. And that is kind of the aim of what I do. And I say to people, like, just try to be talking like you're normally talking. There are acts that do an affected version of themselves, but if you can just talk like you normally talk, and it doesn't look like you're in any way buoyed by the fact, it is weird to have a job that people have on their bucket list, that have as a thing that, oh, I'd love to do this once before I die, or I'd love to give it a go, like whatever. And you're kind of going, oh, that's like literally what I do all the time. Like, but that's very strange that that's a thing that people have as a, or it's their greatest fear. And you're kind of going, surely there are things that are more frightening than this. But it is but if you need it, if you have the emotional lacking in your soul that you need the love of strangers, then you go for it. Like, you go, this is the only way I can be complete. If I make these people laugh, will they love me? Will they like me? Will they approve of me? Then fine. Then I'll be okay for a short while.
I wonder on Mock the Week too, because, like, you're surrounded by your peers and there's a lot of talent in that room. Is that, you know, does it feel as significant to get collective laughter from that small group of people versus much larger audience?
There is a kind of a culture in comedy that there was, like, that we enjoy making each other laugh.
Yeah.
They're funny people to be around, but there isn't a that would be slightly weird that we would be competing. It's actually a bit more relaxed about that. Generally, our common enemy, and this may not be true of all comedy worlds, I think American comedy world is a bit, they tend to regard it as a bit of a zero-sum game. They're traditionally not the friendliest people you meet. But in the UK and Ireland, we have a tendency that our common enemy is the audience rather than each other. And so we tend to, you know, go, oh God, how are they out there? Oh, they're rough tonight, like whatever. You know, you're in that crossover when you're walking on stage. So that's kind of what we do, weekends together in clubs, and we kind of bond by shuffling around Birmingham together, like, kind of thing. But they're good company. Comedians are good company. The worst is if there's a non-comic in who's sitting there looking around going, this is going to be amazing, and we're going, no, we're just going to bitch about each other and complain about clubs we played. We're not actually going to be firing zingers out in any huge way. It's kind of relaxed in that regard. Although I do think partners of comedians find it a bit of a chore, because we just talk about other comedians, and we just talk about, like, it's very, it's very, you know, not necessarily bitchy, but, like, it's still very gossipy. And so I think they find that quite dull. It's not like, oh, I can't go out with you because the laughter is too much. It's just like, could you stop going on about that? You all worked with it in the 1990s. You spent an hour and a quarter. Whatever happened to them? So that's like the going on about nights we weren't at. So, you know.
Partners of Comedians would be a great series, actually. Because it's, you know, you could.
Do you know what? Real comedians' wives, just with them going, oh, fuck, could they just shut up about a time in the laughter lounge and somebody did a thing and they were amazed by it. Because it would also be a series of perfectly normal people. The other name for me, Partners of Comedians, because they're really randomly, there's no pattern to it, like whatever. And they would just be, that's what they do. It's kind of weird. The weird thing I find is that people go, and does your wife come along to all your shows? You're going, are you out of your mind? She, like, has a job, and she's not, like, I've always thought, whenever you see Wimbledon and you see their family there, all in those row of 10 seats, I'd be going, I couldn't shift the 10 seats, that my family have stuff to do, like, they don't want to come see me much. They don't come to see me all the time. They're busy with their lives, like whatever. They don't have a 2 week gap where they can just sit watching me do my stuff. So I always find that really weird. I find the pressure of that worse than to try to fill those 10 seats more than actually winning the tournament.
Can I just ask you briefly before we get into your list, and I wonder if there's a coalescence of time. When did you get into stand-up? When did you realise, actually, that's a job I could do?
The two kind of landmarks now. The first thing, when will I give it a go, was 1995. It was after I went to university and did kind of debating, and then somebody set up a kind of small arts club and said, you should just, you know, crystallize the funny bits and to put a set together. And I tried it, and then I tried it a few more times, and you find yourself doing it. And like, I knew I wanted something broadly media, so I ended up at the start writing for newspapers and doing Echo Island kids TV and gigging and trying all this. Dublin being a place small enough that you can hustle in a few different ways, and then the comedy sort of just kept taking over, being the more interesting thing. So in the mid 90s, but it was probably only at the start of this, at the millennium or 2002 thereabouts, where I realized, oh, this is actually my job, this is actually my career. I think about 7 years in when I realized, no, this is actually what I'm doing now, and that penny dropping kind of led to this is it, this is what I do.
So there's no moment as a teenager watching like Richard Pryor or something going, I want to do that?
I remember that because I have a tendency to, you know, go on, not go, oh, these are my heroes and I really want to do the thing. Except that I do remember when I eventually did, and the important thing that happened in 2002 is I did the Just for Last Festival in Montreal, and then I got a chance to do a gala at that. And I remember I was about waiting to go on, and the music started, and I went, oh, Jesus, that music. And then I remember that I'd watch all of those Just for Last shows when I was a teenager and had loved them and seen Eddie Izzard do the Songe dans l'Arbre all these legendary routines that people did, like whatever. And I went, this had all been buried there somewhere as a thing. So like, yeah, I would have been a big comedy fan, but I've met people who are proper comedy anoraks about stuff like that, and I always feel like I was not, but they were thinking, I admired it. Envied it, maybe that's a kind of a thing, whatever. But I remember seeing probably Eddie Izzard's live DVD, the Dressed to Kill, that myself and my sister got obsessed with at one stage and just watched over and over and over again. And that probably just sank in. But the notion of it there, of doing that, was so unbelievably, I was a dorky kid who's going to do science in university. There's no sense of, oh, well, I'm going to do that, like whatever. But it was just clearly got into the bones. And made me go, okay. Because obviously the first few years, I was like an Eddie Izzard cover act. I was the same rhythm, same pauses, same things or whatever. I had to actually shake that off for a while, after a while. But there was, at the time, I think the notion of doing it was so ludicrous. How would you end up being a comedian? That's madness, madness.
So that's kind of your equivalent to the Champions League music.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's gone. I mean, and there may be points, I'm sure there are points where somebody's about to run out and they went, oh my God, this is my turn to do this. That whole thing of like, well, he'll move to a club where he can play for Champions League. There must be a sense of, you hear the theme music. There was a point, I remember, Ross Noble, I remember this, when I did Have I Got News For You, and I heard that music playing. And then Ross Noble said, also, you hear the shunk, shunk, shunk of the board spinning behind you. And you go, that's the thing I've seen a million times, the board spin, and they've got these montages on behind it, like whatever. And it's just a guy, twists one, runs to the next, twists the next, and runs to the next. There's no fancy, it's the motor doing the whole thing, like whatever. It's not automated, like whatever. But when you hear the theme music, you go, oh, geez, I'm here. I remember sometimes we'd have somebody on Mock the Week, good comics now, whatever. Sean Walsh did it, and he's a fine comic, like whatever. But he said, Sean, you didn't come in for a while. And he said, yeah, one stage I was just watching you all, and then remembered I was actually on the show and not watching the show because I was sitting watching the thing go around. And I went, oh, no, I'm here. I have to say stuff. So there's that.
The hurling and football, where did the hurling love come from?
Clochone. Went to Clochone in Booterstown, and we did a little bit in primary school, and then it's properly school sport in Clochone. And it's for those who don't know, a school, the only kind of Irish language grade school on the south side of Dublin, Clochone, where it was in the middle of the city. And but we were in Stillorgan. I've always characterized it as being like the Gaul village at the start of the Asterix books, where you have that map of France and there's a kind of a magnifying glass, and there's one Gaulish village, and then there's all these Roman encampments. The Roman encampments in this metaphor are Blackrock College, St Andrews, Michael's, all rugby, and then there were this one little Jay enclave in the middle of this occupied territory of all these rugby schools. So we were always there. And like, I mean, now it's quite a sophisticated operation, I imagine, because they're fed in with Kula and they're fed in with Croaks, which themselves have become these phenomenal operations. So I think it's at a much higher level than it was. But that's where I picked up a hurley properly for the first time and did 6 years of it there. Played bits of it with club, but Bray wasn't a major hurling stronghold at the time, although it is now, weirdly. They've expanded hugely as a club, Bray Emmett, but it was mainly a club, and then you'd grab games wherever you could for club, play for Kilcool, play for Shankill, play for Bray, wherever I could get a game, play for Cantilly for a while, wherever you could get a game, but school was the main thing.
So you obviously loved it.
Yeah, I did. I adored it, actually, yeah. Was known for my enthusiasm, maybe then for my artistry, probably was, maybe agricultural, perhaps, would be an adjective you'd use to describe my thing. But, you know, was useful. I had a run out for at a minor level for where club for about half an hour, but it wasn't quite there. Like, whatever, that became this weird thing that gets thrown at me all the time about my 30 minutes. It was John Henderson, the former Kilkenny manager, then moved to Bray, who was a manager of the Wicklow team, minor team, briefly for a while, helped out the lads, put me on for half an hour and took me off at half time. So I have met him in later life and we have renewed that. So, yeah, because he was my bête noire for having taken me off during a thing. This is when I was in fifth year as well. And then in sixth year, I just didn't get involved in that much. I had a dodgy knee that would flare up every so often. I've a bit missing from my knee, which has been a kind of a lifelong thing. And that kind of dented me out of it when I got to university age anyway. Plus then my life stuff and there on in, and obviously professionally, just makes you completely, you know, unreliable. For you're not available in the evenings. Yeah. I was never around to play again. But but I have a shonky knee, so that whole thing has to be replaced at some point. Ooh. But there was a glorious point. Every so often I'd go missing for 6 weeks because of a mysterious knee injury and then return. But we had some good moments.
Well, so, go on.
Sorry, was that the last time so that you held a hurley, or would you still puck around now?
I poke around now and again.
Oh, yeah.
And you get relatively few chances. We got a golden retriever recently, and my intention was that I would walk with the dog, strike the ball, and the dog would run and return the ball. I'd strike the ball again. I thought that was how this would proceed. The dog gets bored after two collections, and then you're left walking back to collect the thing yourself. We have a couple of them lying around the house, which I think is handy. I find it handy just emotionally for home security that there's a couple of hurleys lying around the house at all times. But I think a couple of them were left out and have become a bit decayed. Difficult to get a hurley with a band on it as well these days. Mm-hmm. That seems to be very much an old thing, you know. I'm very much ground hurling and swinging wildly and, you know, dirty ball. I'm very much dirty ball. But it's very difficult. But I'm probably due another one. Pick up another one at some stage soon. Then maybe when I go back down to Kilkenny, I'll pick one up. There's a few, and there's a number of Schlitters lying around the house, and a number five O'Neill's football as well. Which I was given by my club when I went back to visit them. They said, here, grab one of these and threw it at me. When I went back to Bray does the Kickfather tournament. I popped in one morning for an All-Ireland season. So there's a proper ball here as well.
Is this in England where the ball is? In the house?
No. Oh, yeah, in London. The house has a number of Schlitters lying around. There's also a trophy with a hurley on it. Yeah, because I do a championship draw with the family, which unfortunately always happens later than the bloody championship starts. So I am burdened with information and that they don't have. But we do a draw and everyone gets two counties, and it's unfortunately it's whoever gets Limerick has won for most of the last 5 years. But it's only starting the last while. But they indulge me in this thing that every year, and there's a trophy I have with a hurley on it with the O'Brien family. hurling trophy, and so whoever wins the championship gets a trophy every year, and a bag of sweets or a five or whatever. So that happens every year. Last year there was a double with my wife. Won both. She got Spain and she got Clare, so she won the fiver for both. And was very good. Oh, have I won? She said, "Oh, great, delighted, just thrilled to win it." But it's up. I stick it up like a wall chart, and so we scratch them off as they get eliminated and everything. Like, so God. So I'm 3 weeks in and I haven't done the draw yet. I have to do it next week.
I imagine the trophy is like the Geller Cup and friends. Like, it's like the family are obsessed with it, and even to explain it to everybody else. But also the size.
I feel.
Sorry, go on.
No, I feel they haven't become obsessed with it. It's very much still on my desk every year. Like, it's not past.
Keep going. Just
and also, like, occasion the hurling, because I got it from a trophy shop in London, actually. And after a couple of years, the glue holding the hurling facade fell off, and there's a different, like, there's a golf thing underneath it. So it was very much fashioned by some company there. They stuck it on. It's not perfect.
Your first selection is actually a hurling match from 1990, the Dublin Schools hurling final, Colosh to Owen versus St David's Artane, a good south side north side battle. Did you win?
We won. We won with 3 late goals, and it was the first time our school had won the Dublin hurling. Our year was probably not regarded as one that was most likely to do it. We had a slightly smaller pool of players, but we younger lads as well on the team. And then for some reason we got to the end, and with some crazy semi final where we beat. Jeez, it wasn't our school reach. It was one of the other ones. We beat them 5-2 to 4 goals. It was some mess of a game. And I remember almost getting, because one of their parents was going, "Well, you never win a final if you can't score points." And I said, "Well, score more than you did." And then it was like a standoff in Fairview, myself and with these other parents or whatever. But we went to the final. I played twice in Croke Park, once under 16 football, where we had a draw and then lost the replay elsewhere. And then once in this match where we were ahead for a while, and then we scored 3 goals in the last 5 minutes and walked away. It was very much like Offaly. It was a school's version of Offaly versus Limerick in 94. There was a point very early on in the game though where I was cornerback, and then I was marking a lad who caught a ball and ran and didn't score, I think, but got around me and laid the ball off. And then the second time the ball came down, he was reaching up to field it, and I had a genuine moment where I, sort of a dorky maths guy, this is like 3 minutes away from the leaving cert, like whatever was clear, you know, very much. And I had a moment where I weighed up, you know what, I really have to do this, like whatever, and I just clapped him across the knuckles as he was reaching for. He had the hurley up to protect his hand, and I went, "This, I'm sorry." And in an almost very deliberate way, at some point I must be reunited with him to apologise for this, knocked him across the arm, and he did nothing then for the rest of the day. It was a premeditated act of just, but that's the game, you know. We should have done, the first thing they taught us was you hold the hurley so it protects your hand when you go up to catch it. He had not done that, and I went, "Sorry about that, champ." And knocked it out of his hand there were a couple of times, you know, a couple of heroic clearances down the field, you know. It was even this is old Croke Park, even if you only bring it in a load of school kids, there's a great noise in the thing, so it was a fantastic thing to have done it. And we were the first, and the school then went on to win, or to certainly get into All-Ireland finals semi-regularly, and now plays its hurling in Leinster. We would then go from Dublin, because I remember a moment where we took that victorious team, went into Leinster, proper Leinster, and we played some team down the country, and they absolutely, and there's a guy there who skinned me, scored 3 goals on me, and I remember as I'm running after him going, "Yeah, but my leaving cert's gonna be better." And it'd be a definite moment where I went, "This is over now." This, I'm far more aware of the fact that I'm much more worried about the fact that I'm gonna get, you know, I'm going for my maths, I'm scoop. Fine, well done, you. Great, good for you, right? I'm already, my head is already elsewhere. So that was. Whether or not I've no idea if it did. He may have done very well. He may be a leading, you know, oncologist now who is also very good at hurling. But I took it kind of a smug and screw you, I'm gonna get more points than you. So it's grand. Yeah. You win this one, my friend, I said.
Is it possible that you remember more about that campaign than you do about some of the bigger gigs you've had in your life, that this is burned into you for whatever reason?
Yeah, it was a big, and certainly there was greater nerves when the whole school, like when a ball broke and you had to get it up and get it out. The I remember being petrified. I remember saying this to a friend of mine who said he never enjoyed playing, and I remember that feeling. There's a video game, FIFA, the video game for one stage had this mode where you could play as one player, and when the ball came to you, the camera view would shorten down, would come down, would contract, and it became very, very close. And you're kind of going, I'm not sure professional footballers, if you get to the level, if they do what we do when we got the ball, which is, oh shit, just don't lose the ball. I think they look around and see what you can do with the ball. Whereas I remember distinctly the sense of like, I have the ball and now my options have narrowed down to get rid of it up the field. There was no point where I, as a cornerback, would go, I think I'll play a short little pass to the guy who's wing back ahead of me. Like, there's none of that was going on. Occasionally you'd see players that do that and going, how are they doing that? How have they the time to do that? I think I was, I've got it, great. And I could get it. And I think, like, for example, you get very good at when the ball's coming down with the hurley over your head. I was extremely accurate. I wouldn't even have to look, right, I know I'm running, I'm batting, and it's going to bounce in front of me because I'm not going to miss that. And I'm already in the run ahead to gather it up and clear it out. But there's no sense of me going, how shall I spread the play? It was very much, how much distance can I get on this in a central, let's lock it down the central line here, like the ESK. So it wasn't sophisticated. But I do remember the petrifying fear of this going wrong. I remember a run that somebody did for Old School Reach going in that to this day I should have tripped him because we would have beaten them in this match. As it turned out, maybe that would have led to the draw not working out as well, because Old School Reach were our sworn enemies. They may not even notice us, but there was a lad got through and I should have swiped him, or I should have hooked him, or he should have done something. And not only should I have done that because it would have stopped a goal occurring, but I also should have done it because the referee was a guard from Bray who was involved in the Bray Emmett hurling team, and he would not have sent me off. In fact, the referee gave me a lift back from the match to Bray, and so I've always felt Martin wouldn't have sent me off for that. I should have done him. I wasn't a dirty player like the. It was like that was why the swipe in the final was so out of character. But I should have done him because I would have been there going, "Oh, ref, come on!" And like with a wink, and he would have gone, "No, all right, come on. Here, I'll let you go." So I would have got away with it, and I regret that moment to this day.
Should we stick with the hurling, because this isn't sequential? So that was 1990. There is one other hurling match, but it's an intercounty match, Kilkenny against Tip, the drawn final in 2014. Of all the hurling matches that you've been to.
And there was certainly a case of that the strong argument for 2013, Cork versus Clare, the chaos final of 2013, would have been a better choice. Also, as a moment, Canning's free that drops short when Limerick win for the first time, I was sitting directly behind that. So I could watch the arc of the ball drop down, and you're going, Jesus, if that was, like, there was some point where if the free had been moved forward 10 yards, Limerick's, who knows what would have happened, they would have done it eventually, but still, that on that day it dropped short and then got cleared out, like whatever. There's a million of these kind of moments, but I just remember that particular final being the most immaculate game from both teams, that there was hardly a missed shot for the length of it. Like, it was something insane. It was at a point where we weren't regularly getting 30 points per team, which we are sort of getting now, and I'm sort of one of those advocates for, like they did in tennis, take the air out of the ball slightly, you know, let's bring it back so that you can't hit it 100 yards regularly like Limerick do. But it was so let's get touch back into it, you know, let's make hurling great again. But that one was just the most exquisite. So I remember turning to the lad I went to, John Mitchell, who attended a number of these finals too, and going, have we seen any wides at all in this game? And it was at the point where Galway and Tipperary had these epic clashes, and that particular final, although I couldn't name a moment as much as just the moment of going, there's another one. It was just swung, and they both high pressure each time, and they just kept responding with immaculate shots over and over again. And it was the most, I think for me, the most perfect encapsulation of just accuracy an intensely pressurized event. Yeah, there were more fun, crazy finals than that. But I think that was just the most exquisite one. I thought that's why I picked that one.
The Arsenal one that you picked, right, is Thierry Henry's
Yes.
It's a comeback.
Lots of different arguments.
Yeah.
Thierry Henry comes back 2012, having had gone to Barcelona, broken a heart, having gone to New York, played for the Red Bulls, came back briefly for a summer tournament once. We all cheered him there. Came back against Leeds at a point where, in my memory, he's 43. He's not 43.
He's a massive beard. I remember that.
Yeah, he had a beard, huge beard back there. And then we're playing Leeds in an FA Cup match, a very kind of ordinary FA Cup. This is not the greatest Arsenal team of all time. And we're kind of struggling to put away Leeds. And a point came where he was brought on. The place is at fever pitch because he's come back on again. Alex Song gets the ball in midfield, and you can almost see it unspooling. You can see him start to make the run, Henry. And Song threads the ball between two defenders. Henry picks up in the Henry position, coming in from the side, and then does a slightly curved diagonal finish. And I every blade of grass of that ball going slowly, you know, just in exactly into the corner. And then the room erupted. And the main reason I remember it is because my brain did a thing which it occasionally does, and maybe I should get this checked out, whereby I disassociate. The rush of adrenaline is so huge that it's like that. Do you not see in a movie where there's an explosion, and then for a while the characters are walking around and this kind of ringing noise and everything is slightly that? I go into that fugue state where there's so much joy that I can't actually, that it's like I'm distanced from it all. Like I'm not out of body entirely, but my brain is not coping with the amount of adrenaline that I've produced. And it does this kind of ringing, everything gets muted and I'm out of the thing, like whatever. And it's just crazy. And then it all comes rushing back in again. Really, I've got to ask somebody who knows brain chemistry if this is a good thing, because it happens semi-regularly. When we score a goal at a very important moment. It didn't necessarily happen, I think, for the Declan Rice free kicks that I was at for a couple of weeks ago against Real Madrid, but it has happened. It happened when Arshavin scored against Barcelona for Arsenal when they won that time. It's happened, I think, when Henry scored the winner against Man United. We all remember there are certain moments, because it's like, there's this whole thing about, oh, when did the Emirates, has the Emirates finally become blah blah blah, all the thing, but actually it's happened, you know, we've got a catalogue of great moments now, or great victory, whatever, that we can call it. We've not won a league there yet, but we've had moments of just where the place has just gone insane. But that was one of those, because it was like an FA Cup match on a Wednesday night, there was no reason for it to be. And then, of course, the minute I posted a tweet going, Thierry Henry might have broken my brain, I'm so happy. And then I got a lot of my responses about how I really shouldn't, how dare I, that's disgraceful. And you're kind of going, sorry for that. Like, yeah, I know, but I have learned to forgive the man who plays for my club, as we often do. And in our, you know, in the way that we do this, our club tends to trump this a bit. So it was a remarkable moment.
The heart is deceitful above all things. Do you love Mikel Arteta? Because I look back at the highlights of that game, and he's only 34, by the way. He could easily have played another 5 or 6 years. He was in such good shape, Thierry Henry.
Yeah.
Arteta was pulling the strings from midfield. Are you a lover of Arteta?
I do, and I think what he's done is incredible. I find it very funny that I've had a number of Manchester United supporters going, oh, this must be the time, he must be under some pressure now, and you're kind of going, you're 14th. So, you know, what, you know, and specifically Man United fans doing this, going, oh, I must be under a lot of pressure now, you know. No, really, I don't think he is, like, whatever, I'm not sure, you know, we'll play PSG, obviously, and I'm not sure we're going to get through that, but PSG are exceptional. The first 20 minutes, the other night was like, we all went, oh, whoa, 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 that's, they're good. Wow, they do this very, very well. It was as a complete a domination as I've seen us go through. So, you know, we might not get past them, but we're in the last four teams of the Champions League. No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, look, it's not been a great domestic thing, and we are due a renewal of certain positions, I think. But I think we had everyone playing for us last year and we got 89 points. This year we did not. And if you struck out the players we've had lost this year out of most of the squads, I think a lot of how this works is you have to be lucky in terms of who you lose and don't lose. And we were very lucky last year, and we were very unlucky this year. this year. I mean, it's an awful shame. We 89 points wasn't enough to win the league last year, but there you go. But I'm still, having sat through the bit where I thought the club was going to become a Walmart, essentially. I thought it was going to become like just a, I think that we all attended and we come sixth or seventh or whatever. I thought the ambition seemed to have gone completely from the place. During the Unai Emery, when we're coming eighth, and I felt there was no investment or there's no sense of the passion about it at all. I'm very happy with let's get back to the point where that we're fighting for second, although it doesn't look like we're fighting very hard for
not
second.
Not a minute, no.
Yeah,
spooning towards it.
Yeah, if that, you know, I'm saying honestly, we're maybe relying on other people's results, like with the spread. I suspect we're going to come third or fourth, just because the energy's gone out of it, we'll see. But and also in their next two matches, our Anfield and Newcastle, and Newcastle have beaten us three times already this year. Yeah. So I think a lot might be resting on a game against Southampton on the last day, which is not the position we wanted to find ourselves in. But it's trickling away a little bit. But it's still, to be in the game at all is so much more of a result than as opposed to where we were for about 3 or 4 years, where it felt from the top down there just wasn't any drive in the club, and you had this nightmare fear of they can just make money with us coming sixth or seventh.
Yeah,
you know, we can just be this kind of brand that's in and around the whole thing, and that there's no need for them to push to get to this. So like the fact that we are at this is a huge change to where I thought we were 5, 6, 7 years ago.
You were describing Spurs there, weren't you?
Yeah, well, you know what? There's a lot of them. And in fact, maybe United have been the same thing for the last part, that clubs can exist, can tread water, and yet be a very financially successful entity to have, like whatever. Because not everyone's going to win a trophy. So therefore, just to be in the tournament. I'm sure there's, you know, they're very rich owners of American clubs who don't have to make a lot of money. We could be that. We could be, you know, pick a mediocre basketball team who just are in the league and the crowd will turn up no matter what. So there was a worry that we would just get taken for granted and we'd be in some weird limbo. It's like some Black Mirror episode where we're trapped in this USS Callister. We're just trapped in this thing forever, maybe get a game in the Champions League every so often, like maybe get a bit of European thing with it, maybe get an FA Cup, like whatever, but like we're never really up at the top, like whatever. We've shaken that off, and so I think it'll be interesting. I think it's going to be a very important summer.
What do you make of AFTV?
I haven't really. Yeah, they have passions. They have grand passions. And it was when it became a bit of a cliche around the time the Wenger out stuff. I haven't been mad about it. I think that was their big moment, and I don't think it's kind of. I think it's gone on a different trajectory since then. Occasionally when you exit the stadium, you can see the cluster of people and the lights, and you go, I'm staying a long way away from that. Walk to the back of that shot, I think. But just shouting bruv confidently, constantly at each other, like whatever, come on, it's going on, bruv. They're just getting really angry, like, no, I'm all right, thanks, I'll just go somewhere quietly around nearby and have a pint. I don't need that. So no, the one I always see is actually there's a Liverpool guy who is this bald Dublin Liverpool guy who does the live commentary of the matches, who every time he's on, somebody goes, oh, see, you're very upset again, Dara, because like all middle-aged bald men, he looks slightly like me. And so I get sent him repeatedly. And he's got to calm down as well. He really does.
To bracket together the other two, they're both Olympics. The Women's Olympic Boxing Finals in 2012. I presume it's Katie Taylor?
It is Katie Taylor. However, shout out for the British boxer who won as well.
Natasha Jonas?
Or? No. Black Yorkshire. I think she's a police officer. What's her name again? Oh my God, she did the dancing show afterwards. It was fantastic. Oh, somebody looked that up, who won the thing that day, because there were three bouts, obviously. There's the Katie Taylor bout, which is the middle bout, which was all the effort, all the emotion went into that. It was insane. Nicola, it's going to kill me. She won the first bout and was roared mightily.
Nicola Adams.
Nicol Adams is fantastic. She won the first final, was roared mightily by the crowd. Everyone kind of decided to go, we're going for her. Great. Then the Katie thing, which was this insane thing where we won the first round, lost the second round, and then there was no points up on the last one. And I was covering it for a BBC thing. I blagged in with the BBC and we're sitting there with for some reason, it said no normal mics will work. So we'll have to give you those kind of 1950s microphones with a metal clip that goes under your lip. And so it looked like we were doing some sort of Hindenburg disaster commentary, like where it was a ridiculous looking thing. And 10 seats away from me, I took a photograph of a woman in a beehive covering her ears like this, whatever. And it was Princess Anne. And I used to put that out in post and go, who's this? Guess what? And it's Princess Anne shielding her ears from the noise in XL. Just because it was all like, I mean, the random ticketing managed to find 10,000 Irish people out of a crowd of 12,000. And then the place obviously went ballistic. And then there's this really weird bit before, I think they did the third final before they did the national anthems and the medals, where there was just another final. And there was just a mad kind of, everyone just hung around for the last final and we just picked somebody. It was like we went, okay, the American. And we all just whimsically decided to follow the American woman in the last final, who also won. So we were delighted about that. But in a real kind of a, yay, well done. We don't really care that much. We've had our fun. And then they had then they did the Aaron Avian and I got to belt out Aaron Avian. So that was a lovely thing. I think I may have shed a tear on camera, which is not a thing I've done that often. And that was spectacular. That was just a glorious thing. And to get into blagged in as well was quite nice because it was an Olympics in which I bought like tickets for the velodrome off somebody in the toilets of the Olympic Stadium the day before. there was a whole thing going on to get into stuff, like, and get as much stuff as possible, and I managed to swing tickets. And the payment for doing the thing, the report, which is great fun to do anyway, was they gave us tickets to the athletics, and we got to see the 800 meters final, where with the fastest 800 meters final in history with
Rhodesia.
Wow. Yeah. And I think there was one, but anyway, we saw that incredible performance. So there was, again, phenomenal individual performances.
Why so emotional for Katie?
Singing Aaron Avine on a, on an international stage might have been that. There may be a Bray element to it as well, after all. But she had comfortably displaced me from the Bray fame chart. There's a constant clatter of me and, Laura Whitmore and Hosier fighting for the lower places, while Katie has just kept herself there at the top of that, like whatever. So I was moving down the brackets in the tennis club chart, like whatever. But I don't know. I think it was a bit of Aaron Avine. Here we are on the national stage, international stage. I didn't cry now for the other one you're going to say. The other one I mentioned, I didn't cry during that, which is the men's pommel horse final in 2024, which I got tickets. It was a 50-50 shot of when the finals were, because they said it'll be there are individual finals and there are two afternoons of them. And it didn't say when you're buying the tickets which ones they were. And I had to go one or the other because of the way it was working out. And I'm going to remember going for that one. And luckily, that was Reese McClenahan's final. Oh. And that was a phenomenal event to be at, because Simone Biles was on before, and as a kind of a warm-up, Simone Biles was doing her greatest event. So she was doing the horse and she did the phenomenal spin, saying, is it called the pop? What she does?
It's the thing where she jumps onto the beam. Isn't
yeah, exactly. Not under the beam. She does a flip over the thing, and then she flipped again, and it was the most incredible thing. Honestly, one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen. Like whatever, remarkable thing. And then she walked away with that one, and then loads of people cleared out after that. They weren't like us, happy to just to have got the tickets. They'd seen Simone Biles and went, I've done now. I've seen the thing or whatever. So half the room was there for the pommel horse final, which was just insane because the guy from Kazakhstan came out, set an insane level, and sent this ripple to the room of suddenly there's no safety net. This guy he's on 50.3, I think, who's right out of the gate. And it collapsed. Everyone collapsed. Your man, Whitlock, Max Whitlock, just couldn't keep up with it. Reese came out, nailed it. The most nerve-wracking thing I've ever seen in my life. because it's the most insanely precise thing of ever in the world, landed. And we had no idea. I just remember being in just absolute tenterhooks for the entire length of it. And then he lands and grins, and you go, okay, fine. that must have been good. They gets to whatever he gets, 15.6, whatever it is. And then to the rest of the field, it just was, because the standard was set was so high, it was fall after fall after fall after fall. It was only the American, the guy with the glasses, yeah, who was able to hold it together at all. But everyone else just was like the pressure just. So McLennan and I bumped into them later at the Irish club, whatever it is, the bar. They came in, and the place cleared out, and my wife said, "Look, we can get around to where they are. We're the opposite side." So we ran around to where the medals are being handed out amidst all the Irish Olympic group. And he was waving up like whatever and smiling, and she said, "Oh, he must have seen you." I said, "He's not. He's seen the rest of his people here." It'll be ridiculous. The medal ceremony, fantastic. Aaron Aveen again. I was walking through Paris with my wife that evening. I said, "Look, I'm feeling very Irish at the moment. I'm going to have to go and be among Irish people." She said, "I will look after the children." I said, "Thank you very much." And I ran to where the Irish bar was. Met a load of people, met a load of various swimmers and runners and various people there, like chatting away to loads in there. And then Rhys came in, and I burrowed my way through to come over and go, "Hello, I was there." And he said, "I know, I saw you." and then I met the coach, and I said, "Look, how long was that?" And this is the key thing. He said, 10 years of training for 49 seconds.
Wow.
49 seconds of precision, every hand, 10 years of training. And I said, "Oh, look, I was there." He said, "Yeah, I know you were there. We heard you singing the national anthem."
Oh, that's class. It was.
I properly bellowed it out. Like, I was absolutely, because it's the Gaeilge thing as well. You know what I mean? You don't get to do much Gaeilge on the international stage, like whatever. And in fact, you know, I was representing as well, because it wasn't, you know, it's not everyone knows the words to it. So I was giving it socks in Bercy Arena.
You did well not to cry from the sheer tension of it, because like a lot of Olympic goals are sorted, you know, like straight away, like in the running and the swimming, you know you've won. But in McLennan's case, you know, he had done his routine and he had to wait and wait and wait.
Yeah. But there was a conversation. I think they knew that it had gone well anyway. After the last final, you know. But I think that's remarkable in itself. Like, when it all comes down to that, because you see yourself in the room, because it's so silent, and all you're hearing is the twack, twack, twack of the hands on it, and you're seeing the legs just clear the thing constantly. And you're going, "God, that could at any moment, because we'd already seen one person scrape it off and then have to come back and onto it again. And then it was a series, three or four of them after that, like whatever. It was it's a remarkably tense thing. And for it all to be on that, I think he's doing two in the next one, or he's aiming for that anyway. I think he's doing the floor as well. And that'll open it up, obviously. But it was a remark. I don't think I've ever been as tense for like that, for something than that. And yet, again, without the release of going, "Wait, what?" Because, yeah, you're right. You don't know. But you're just like, it's done. He's done the thing, like whatever. All we can do now, he couldn't do any more than that. He's done that thing perfectly. And now we wait. But it was a spectacularly intense moment. Lovely fella coming. And he said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "Look, it's crazy." He said, "Oh, I've got tickets to see in Vicar Street." And then he did the dancing show. So he didn't actually get to come along, but he's going to come along to one of these Vicar Street shows. So at one of the nights, he'll be there, like whatever, hopefully. The least I could do.
When are those Vicar Street nights, Sarah?
That's in July. It's the first two weekends in July. And they're kind of the last run of this show. I've done that. Weird to me, I'm kind of in my headspace now. I'm at the start of the English tour, having almost forgotten I've done 19 Vicar Street. Sorry, I've already done all this block. But we're coming back to do another two weekends of it. And it's the room, having done it in England now, please come and see it in Vicar Street. England's grand, but it has this sense of this thing being at home when it's in Vicar Street. It's just such a lovely room, and either it has shaped how I talk, or it just dovetails really nicely with telling the story. It's a lovely story to tell, and there's a big reaction thing at the end, so it's a really nice thing to do. So please, it's honestly, if it could be, you know, I'm always telling people, "Oh, come on to the show," but this one is one that I will, when I stop being able to tell the story, and particularly when Dan's in that room, I will miss it a lot. It just works really, really well. So, start of July.
And is this the end of you being able to tell that story? Is that what you think?
So yeah, it'll be. We don't know. We'll see. We may try to speed it up, but I think this might be the last two weekends. But the okay. We'll see. Yeah, I mean, if I'm back here going, hello, hi, look, we've managed to squeeze a few more in. That's the joy of the Vicar Street thing. Is if it goes, you can add on to it, like whatever. But we've done most of it now, and so it's a case of please, if you're anyway, it's. But there's just sometimes life gives you a story, and it's, like this thing. There was a story about adoption. The last one. This is kind of a second chapter to it. Like the that. Just when it happens to you, you go, oh, I'm going to tell this and it's going to be very good. And there are things, stories that if it happened to me in my 20s and 30s, I would have done a 5-minute version of it and I would have kind of wasted it a bit. Now you know, oh, no, we can probably settle in and get every, we can get a lot out of this, like whatever. And then there'll be a dramatic at the end. And every night, you know, when you're totally doing, going, oh, in a minute now, in a minute, something's going to happen. Yeah, it's a very nice feeling. When you know I got this ready to go and something's going to happen, you're going to love it. You're absolutely going to love it. So it's great. So well, anyway,
we're looking forward to it. Dara, that was sensational. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We loved it.
Look, I would happily prattle on about this stuff forever. I absolutely adore it. Like whatever the Escad, the list numbers 6 to 10 were pretty good as well. At no stage do any of my choices feature the words "free from desire." Although everything I went to featured the words "free from desire." Yeah. But there was a, yeah, look, it's just a, I want to lose, I'll end this conversation, I'll go, wait, what am I doing? What about the men's Greco-Roman tournament of 1974? That was a classic as well. But yeah, it's been a delight, lads, an absolute delight.
Thanks a million. Cheers, Dara.
Good luck.
See ya.
You have to be there.